Today's episode of the Energy Newsbeat podcast is brought to you by Enverus. The energy industry faces massive challenges every day, and the events over the last 2 years have caused huge disruptions like never before. Companies in the energy industry need actionable intelligence and a single source of truth that brings all the data together. Enverus is the energy specialized technology partner that provides intelligent connections for a global energy ecosystem. Only Enverus has the analytics, people, experience, and industry scope to connect the right data and information in the right way to discover missed opportunities and deliver fast outcomes. Find out more at Enverus.com. That's Enverus.com.
Hey, everybody. Welcome to the Energy Newsbeat podcast today. My name's Stu Turley, President and CEO of the Sandstone Group, and I just want to give a shout out to Enverus. They are our podcast sponsor and just absolutely fabulous folks. And if you want to know anything about data in the energy space, you got to use Enverus. And so today we have Ryan Luther. He is a senior VP over at Enverus. Not that I'm kind of biased about Enverus or anything, and he's covering the energy transition space and had three different reports come out. And we're going to talk about the ERCOT and the report. So, Ryan, thank you and welcome to the podcast today.
Yeah, thanks for having me, Stu.
You're up there in Calgary, and how cold is it right now up there?
It's freezing. It's white out. It's very cold. I'll be down in Phoenix next week. So,
oh, super.
Escape the cold for a short period.
And so Ryan, when you're as a senior VP up there, what do you look at for Enverus?
So I'm helping lead our energy transition group, which, covers kind of everything from, very classic power research. And part of that is renewables. A lot of that is also looking at those thermal gas and coal plants, which, Enverus has a lot of experience with. On the commodity side. And so anything from that to looking at, carbon capture. I think you had Heather Leahy on the other day, who's kind of our expert there. We look at renewable fuels, pretty much everything and anything that's kind of transition focused.
Nice.
But I'd say more leaning towards helping lead some of the power research.
Well, the three reports that you just put out, let's kind of go ahead and start with number one. And as we take a look at, everybody had when ERCOT had the real problems before, the memes went nuts. And I'm sorry, I had a lot of fun making a lot of memes about that. So tell us about that first report and some things and updates on ERCOT.
Yeah, for sure. So that first report was really trying to dive into kind of the current state of the energy storage market in ERCOT. Storage is relatively new there. It's really, started kind of blowing up this year. And there's a ton of capacity getting added over the, by kind of this time next year, there's going to be about 9 gigawatts of storage capacity operating on the grid. So it's really gone from 0 to 100. And that first report was really just trying to understand, when everybody thinks about storage, grid storage, they think about arbitrage models, just buying when prices are low and selling when prices are higher later that day. And what we're trying to understand is that what these assets are actually doing? And what we found is that that's not really how they're making their money. They're mostly pursuing ancillary services.
Let's back up a hair because you hit a question on the grid ERCOT they're using the balancing authorities when they try to buy and sell electricity on standby and those. I just want to make sure everybody understands that. Did I just say that correctly?
That's right. Yeah, they're operating as a grid asset, a generator or as a load where they can sell power into the grid and buy it back.
And so, Ryan, I'm trying to help my two listeners out there. Just kidding. and you hit on that is that as the balancing authorities are kind of storage comes back in and then can come online quickly as opposed to a coal plant having to wait a while. Is that a correct statement?
Yeah, that is true. Especially when you think about as an ancillary service. kind of opportunities. Yeah, like one of them is non-spinning reserve, which is designed for longer startup times,
right.
Whereas batteries are kind of immediate. And when you think about the regulation up and down, like it's very responsive, kind of a service you get out of batteries. So there is a really good fit into some of those services. There is challenges though as well, because especially when you think about reserve services, you know, that's for when a generating asset goes offline or when a transmission line goes offline. And usually those kind of problems take longer than, you know, an hour or two to resolve. It could take days. Whereas most of these storage assets are being designed with like a 1 or 2 hour storage duration. Ooh. And so they're not necessarily providing that reliability that a gas peaker plant would be if it was, you know, able to get turned online for those reserve services.
So they're really helping fill a solar and wind fill-in gap or Band-Aid, I guess is a good way to say that then. Is that correct?
I would say, and particularly in ERCOT, you have this dynamic where, you know, demand peaks in the evening and, you know, it's lowest in the middle of the night. Wind is actually highest in the middle of the night and lowest in the middle of the day. And solar is kind of higher in the middle of the day. So you get this, you get a really strange dynamic where, you know, there's a lot of wind, not necessarily when you want it. And that will force prices to go negative. And that creates a great opportunity for a storage asset to buy up that, you know, very low cost energy and be able to sell it back when it's more valuable.
Now, and again, I don't know enough about the balancing authorities and stuff. So does a storage unit buy excess power? Because Texas has one nuke, but do they buy the excess power from somebody as it's excess? How does that work to get the power into the storage? Do they have to buy it and then it's a profitability thing on the storage?
Yeah, so that's a great point. So storage can be co-located with like a generation resource.
Okay.
So like a nuclear or more often like solar or wind plants will co-locate, and the storage asset can just buy it or, you know, take it right from that plant without it ever going into the grid.
Okay.
But more often, or a lot of cases in ERCOT, they're just putting them on the grid, wherever they can place them, and they're pulling it just from the transmission system.
Okay. But do they have to buy it?
Yeah. Okay. They have to pay for it to take that power out, but they'll pay a wholesale price for that power. So, yeah, there's okay. times of the day where that price could be very low. You have a lot of wind generation and nobody else wants to buy it. They could buy
it pretty low. As a business process, then, again, I'm having so much fun because like visiting with Tom Denson over at Fry, understanding the business model of storage is pretty darn cool. And so if they're having to buy like a regular power plant, And coming in on this, they're going to buy at a low cost and then sell it at a higher cost in order on the balancing authority. So they're really a fast spin up or Ferrari of energy in that business model.
Yeah, the problem that storage is solving is the variability in renewables and the mismatch in, you know, renewables being, you know, non-dispatchable and demand, you know, having its specific timing. So they do really fill that void on a daily basis. Right. The challenge is, like, you know, to make that arbitrage economic model make sense, you need to be doing a lot of cycles. So there's a lot of seasonal variation in renewables, which lithium storage is not really going to fill that void. You know, right. It's really just not going to make sense to store power for months at a time and then sell it back to the grid.
You know, as working for Enverus, you guys know data, and my head exploded trying to understand the storage model into the grid. And so this report really going into that has, so the people just think as the grid is the plug in the wall, and it's a lot more complicated than that. So the storage aspect could help the balancing authority guys have to go there. There's so many alcoholics that are balancing authorities because they're so stressed out all the time that the storage does help them in an easier way. That's a joke.
Yeah. I got that. No, I totally agree with that. It's quite a complicated business model to be pursuing. Like the grid, the topology of the grid is changing all the time. So you can add, you know, a new generation asset or new transmission line, and it completely will change the pricing dynamics at certain nodes. So you really have to be careful when you're thinking about, you know, where do I want to build a storage asset where I can get that kind of large arbitrage spread every day for, you know, this foreseeable future.
Right. So in your first report, what do you think your summaries or key bullet points were? Because I keep dragging you offline. I'm sorry.
Yeah, you bet. So I would say, like, you know, when we think about storage, we're thinking that, you know, they're all doing this arbitrage strategy of just buying low and selling high. And right, that was the main conclusion from the first report, was that, you know, they're actually not doing that. They're mostly offering ancillary services where they'll do regulation up, down to regulate the frequency of the grid, or they'll provide reserve services. And when you think about the profitability for these assets, you know, doing one cycle of arbitrage per day where you might get $100 a megawatt hour on the spread, that's $100 per, you know, megawatt of your capacity. But you could also be doing reserve services where you're getting paid every hour of the day. So you're getting paid 24 times instead of once. So that's why, you know, ancillary services are such a more profitable business model.
And I didn't understand this until I talked to Meredith, who wrote Shortening the Grid. And you get paid for being on standby.
That's right. Yeah. Whether or not you get deployed, you're getting paid.
That to me seems a very valuable solution for the batteries and storage.
Totally. Yeah. I mean, you think about it, there's no cost of having a battery sit there. It's no operating cost, right? So
right.
Well, if you're getting paid, and especially if you get paid more than you would make doing an arbitrage cycle, it makes perfect sense for you to just sit there and do nothing. Or do nothing, you know, 95% of the time. They do get deployed sometimes.
See, and that part of the business model, when I first started taking a look at everybody saying storage is expensive, you don't look at that, oh, I'm going to get paid having it just sit there. So that's pretty darn cool. So as Enverus looks at the grid, the profitability and these things, you guys are helping everybody decide whether or not they want to even buy into that market, how it works with clients. Tell us about how Enverus, you take a look at all that mess.
Yeah, for sure. The way we work with our clients is, we're really trying to provide like a really detailed analytical view at these businesses and understanding the technology and the economics. And, you know, we think it's really important to properly understand the economics. You have to actually have a deep understanding of the interactions of the technologies and how these assets are actually working every day. So that's what we're trying to provide to our clients is, you know, just a bit of a deeper dive on the technical side, a data-driven approach. We're working with everyone from big utilities, battery companies to just your private equity investors that are, you know, funding these big, you know, some of these pretty big companies have big capital budgets to go build these assets.
You know, one of the I saw a demo not very long ago of I can't remember which product, I'm old, but, you know, of some of the products that Enverus has that I don't think anybody else could really put together because of the numbers coming from oil, numbers coming from gas, numbers coming from everything else, and then being able to assimilate all these things. Assimilation is critical in the business model. I don't know how y'all do that.
Yeah, I'd say that's on our, it's definitely our expertise on our product side is connecting different data sets. And yeah, there's a lot of, it's definitely not easy to connect some data sets, but making that connection makes it incredibly valuable because if you have to go out and analyze and make that connection every single time and pull down new data, it's, you know, you're going to spend half your time just organizing these data sets. So it automated through our system just saves all of our clients a ton of time.
You know, shoot me. I have a team that, you know, on data stuff and I keep getting grumpy at them. Anyway, when we go to the second report, how did that fold into the first report and what was that one?
Well, so what we found was, looking at the interconnection queue and all the projects that are planned to come online in ERCOT, there's only so much requirements for these ancillary services. So there's about 9 gigawatts a day of total requirements across those 4 different ancillary services. By the end of, around kind of this time next year, we're expecting there to be enough storage assets to supply all of those ancillary markets. And
nine gigawatts.
Yeah.
9 will support all of ERCOT.
All of the ancillary service market. Yeah. And so
Wow.
What that means is, like, right now, those ancillary service prices, they're being set by the marginal bidder, which is natural gas peaker plants for the most part.
Okay.
And the challenge there is that, the interesting part there is that natural gas plants have, very real cost of operating cost. They have a fuel cost to where they get deployed. They're going to have a lot of costs associated with supplying that service. Whereas batteries can charge up overnight when prices are really low and offer that service at a really low cost. So as storage starts to take over the ancillary market, it's going to drive down the prices of the ancillaries quite significantly.
I think that's great. I got a question for you for renewable. And that is, when batteries, the lithium batteries, are to be end of life, and I don't know how long the life cycle battery, because like on an EV, they say 3 years, and then you get to put another $25,000 into a car for whatever the number is. I've seen some real funny memes on that. In the storage aspect of a business model, is that taking a look at that? Do you guys look at the replacement or the... Because I think I remember seeing something on that. And I'm kind of throwing this out as a loaded question. I think you already have the answer to that. So
it's super. That's a really important question about the battery life. Because a battery's life is, it is time dependent. When you get, really far, like after 10 years, even if you barely use a battery, it will degrade.
Right.
But more importantly, it's cycle dependent. It's how many cycles do you do? And so you think about these different ancillary strategies, like you're doing regulation up and down to support frequency. Some of those batteries were cycling their capacity like three times a day.
Okay.
Whereas, and so think about three times a day versus if you're doing the reserve strategies, they're getting deployed 5% of the hours in the year. So they're doing barely any cycles every year. And so you think about that. That has a huge impact on the operating life of the battery, part of that asset. And so it's super important for the economics. It makes a huge difference in those two strategies.
Oh, absolutely. And so when you sit back and think about your front end cost on building the Gigafactory or any of the battery support storage, you got to sit there and think about where does that fall in? Because it's not a 30-year plant. Now, the frame may be a 30-year plan, but you got battery updates in there through that plan. I mean,
totally.
And does each manufacturer have different life cycles that you guys have to figure in when you're putting these things in on going through that? Because you guys really do a great job. And I'm sorry, because I've got, Enverus has 9,000 products and I've seen about 8,000 of them. And so I kind of get a little like your inventory tracking systems for oil and gas and for building things are phenomenal. I mean, you can nail it down to a screw as it's rolling from one end to the other and those kind of things. So what I'm trying to say is, do you help manufacturers as one of your services when they're trying to build another one on what types of batteries to put in? What kind of services do you have in there?
Yeah, for sure. So we have, like, on the power and renewable side, we track the suppliers and the different models of equipment being used for all the different power types. So turbine suppliers, the wind blades.
So I wasn't smoking
solar crack. Inverters and the batteries. Yeah.
Okay.
Totally. And yeah, you're right that on the battery side, like, different manufacturers do have different things like cycle lives. They also have different warranties, which usually the warranty kind of comes to cover, a certain kind of frequency of cycles and cycle life that way. So that's not all, it is very important for sure.
You're not going to go to Batteries Plus or any of those to get these kind of batteries. So, having a warranty is kind of important.
Totally. Totally. And that warranty, the way you choose like a battery and the warranty it offers is really going to be dictated by the strategy that you plan to pursue.
When you sit back and think about disaster recovery on the storage, and again, I I'm a novice on some of this stuff, so bear with me. And you're gonna go back and go, man, that guy was a knucklehead. But I try to get into the right questions, and you say, okay, on the business model for batteries, and you take a look at the section. How do you design the additional load in order to support that? Because there used to be, okay, take 20%. Now, how do you figure the new ones with storage and renewables? And I mean, how does that impact? Because when you put out for grid, you're going to have to say how much additional power has to be on standby. how much of those things. So how does that formula go in there to say, is somebody going to say, is there enough money for us to build an expensive plant? I guess is the right way to say that.
Yeah. Do you mean like how do you calculate like the reserve margin of how much?
Yes. And is it worth us even bringing it in? Cause like, do we need 20% extra, you know, and is the power plant going to be not being called upon by the balancing authorities to even be needed? So you guys even talk about the market that's available, I think is the right way to phrase that.
Yeah. Yeah. It's an interesting dynamic, and like particularly in ERCOT where, you know, they don't have a capacity market, whereas in other ISOs, they have a capacity market to try and incentivize, you know, that reserve capacity to be there. Okay. And so, you know, in ERCOT, lacking that, you know, they depend more on this ancillary service sector to kind of provide that reliability.
Right.
So, you know, they have a larger kind of reserve market, I guess, than some of those other areas.
Okay.
As you think about storage as you know, how it kind of starts to change that is that, like I said earlier, like it's a lot of these durations are pretty short lived. And so that reliability you might need is a lot of times you want a longer duration. And so since publishing these reports, ERCOT's actually come out and banned storage assets from operating in some of those markets unless they have at least a 2 or 4 hour duration, because they need that kind of longer duration to actually provide that service.
Boy, if you take and say instead of an hour versus a 4 hour load is a significant, it's not a just flat take a one price and then add four to it, you know, three to it and think you're going to get there. Cause isn't there exponential when you're building those things?
It's yeah, totally. And and the duration is, you know, one of the most important. And that was, you know, we could talk about it later. That's the third report was thinking about, you know, what impacts the economics, but. Okay. The duration you design these batteries for is one of the most important factors you can pick.
Well, what was the finding in the third report since we're rolling over to that one here?
Well, so you go from, you know, first understand what's the current business model. Second, you know, ancillary prices are going to decline. So you're going to have to, you know, get more of your return. It's going to be based on the arbitrage model. The third series was really looking at, you know, understanding, you know, now that we understand that, we know the profitability is going to decline. What do the actual returns look like, considering kind of this pessimistic view for the operating profits?
Nice.
So baking all of that analysis in, we ran a model. We calculated the economic returns under those different kind of operating strategies of, you know, just doing regulation or reserve or arbitrage or even a combination. And we calculated, you know, what are the returns on, you know, all the different batteries we have data on. So 5,000 batteries across the U.S. that are, you know, in various stages of the queue.
Yeah. Now, and this probably wasn't even in your report, but there's a huge talk about microgrids and micro nukes. And where do you see the next generation of impact to ERCOT? Storage is coming in, because everybody runs around going, "Ooh, it's the newest thing. It's a new sneaker, the new Nike." What would you tell somebody that's coming around the corner?
Well, so that's what's really interesting. Is like we found, you know, storage is pushing down the price of ancillary markets.
Right.
Demand response is the other one, and so demand response. You know, that's where you have a big demand kind of facility. It could be a you know, some kind of like manufacturing plant, a data center,
right?
Or what we're finding in Texas is there's a bunch of crypto mining operations that are trying to provide this demand response.
Right.
And that's another thing that's been pushing down ancillary prices is demand response has been increasing.
Right.
And a lot of that is, you know, from things like microgrids or from, you know, some of the utilities collaborating together, some of their different commercial clients and, you know, using smart meters to, you know, throttle back certain kind of power consumption features of their different businesses at different times.
Right.
But part of that's also crypto. And I'd say that's one of the most disruptive, because building power demand at, you know, asset just to be able to reduce its power load when needed doesn't really solve the actual problem. You know, that means you actually need more generation to service in the other times.
Boy, when all the crypto miners that are out there, they want that cheap, long-term guaranteed price, don't they?
Totally. Yeah.
Okay. So when, with the basic economies of scale of the U.S. and manufacturing, Texas ERCOT has got a lot of businesses in manufacturing that are dropping into Texas. What areas do you see as a growth pattern for power companies and battery companies to start figuring out? Because there's going to be a lot of plants that start popping up all over ERCOT. This has got to be a wild kind of, oh, I thought I ran you off there for a second.
No, you know? No, drop it. But, yeah, no worries.
But you guys are critical for thinking about the future growth. How, because you got all these businesses that are waking up going, I can't afford to be in California. I can't afford to be in these other high areas.
Yeah, totally. And so, you know, that's one of the things we're trying to do with our research is, you know, have a longer term view on, you know, where our intraday spreads going to go and ancillary prices. Right. And, you know, a lot of that, especially when it comes to Texas, thinking about, you know, what is the demand side going to look like? And so,
right,
one, you know, one side of that is there's a, you know, like you mentioned, there's a bunch of population influx going to lower tax states like Texas.
Right.
And, you know, on the manufacturing side, you know, a lot of the Inflation Reduction Act was, you know, figured around doing more manufacturing in the U.S.
Right.
A lot of that stuff with battery manufacturing takes a lot of power. And so you want to be, you know, situated in a place where you can have access to affordable power. Right. And a low tax regime like Texas is good for, right? And particularly, like, you look at, I'd say, like, West Texas in general is a great opportunity for that. Like, you know, I used to cover the Permian Basin back when I was an oil analyst. But right now, covering power, you look at it, like, there's not a ton of power demand out in West Texas, but that's where the sun is the strongest and the wind blows the fastest. So they're building a lot of renewables out there. Challenges.
Oh, yeah.
Is transmitting it to where, you know, the big cities are, is on the other side of the state, and they're not building transmission at the same rate. So for the opportunity to build manufacturing out there, you could take advantage of some of the really cheap power, right?
Oh, yeah. And anybody that's not been over to Abilene or over in that area in West Texas, you sit there and you look at all the wind farms going around and going, I thought this was an oil town. You know, I mean, there's a lot of wind and solar in Texas.
So, yeah, it's an energy state for sure.
And I think
it's not just oil and gas.
No, it's not. And I think ERCOT has got their head. They got their work cut out for them. Just trying to put all that stuff together.
We all do. Yeah, it's evolving quite right. Yeah,
oh, that's
great.
That's
all kinds of issues.
All right. So what's coming around the corner for, I got two questions. What's coming around the corner for your group at Enverus? And then what's coming around the corner for you personally?
Oh, I love that. So yeah, for my group within Enverus, you know, we've been kind of offering this research the last 2 years, or really just officially kind of launched it as a new product. So
okay.
Now, cool. You know, something some of our clients have been getting, but new clients can actually subscribe to our research offering. So that's the big, you know, the biggest development here at Enverus. And, you know, we've got a pretty large team now covering this stuff. We're putting out a lot of great content that I think is quite differentiated. It's, you know, worthwhile reading.
Even if you do so say yourself, you know, you should say that. I mean, you've got a good group of folks.
Yeah. No, there's a ton of talented individuals here. And I'd say, you know, since covering power, I'm coming from oil and gas, like, it's a very, you know, it's a very different space, but there is a lot of research out there. And it's almost, I would say it's like, there's too much research out there. And it almost takes someone to just kind of cut through the noise and figure out, you know, what's actually important. So that's, right. You know, where we're really trying to drive our, you know, audiences, digging through the important issues and actually highlighting that, you know, plain, simple terms.
You know, the one thing I have to respect Enverus for is changing the name when Alan changed the name and everything else to Enverus. I had a hard time Enverus or, you know, everything else. I finally figured out how to say it. But hiring good people, it just seems like Enverus has really figured out the mold to get good people, which is kind of cool. I mean,
yeah. I mean, yeah, it's pretty fun, like, working in energy industry and being, you know, essentially part of like a tech firm, and, you know, we prioritize culture and
right.
Yeah, I think we're able to attract a lot of talented people.
Your HR department is really enjoying not having a bunch of squirrels, you know, working for you and things. But what's coming around the corner for you? You're a senior VP, but what have you got going on that you can share with us? What have you got personally going on?
You mean outside of work or my, you know,
I don't care. I just want to get to know Ryan. I mean, this is
important. Yeah. Yeah. So, well, I'll give you two. So one, you know, we've got a lot of new research coming out on just thinking about how the grid is changing and
right.
You know, we're doing a lot of differentiated, like, it's very complicated modeling you have to do, but I think, you know, we're able to do it in a pretty fast way and put out some really interesting stuff. And so, like I said, like, you know, the storage stuff, thinking about how those, you know, spreads are going to change over the next 12 to 24 months. It's very, you know, tied into understanding, like, you know, what is the gas price forecast for North America, which we've done a very excellent job of forecasting in the past. So I'd say, you know, personally, you know, we've got some reports that are coming out that are super exciting. In my personal life, you know, just excited. It's winter, going to go hit the slopes. Like I said, I'm going to Phoenix next week to play some golf, and then I'll be skiing all winter.
Outstanding. Anyway, I'd love to visit with you sometime, and I'm old enough, I'd love to come ski with you sometime. So we'll have to figure out how to use that excuse.
You have to get up to Calgary.
Oh, that'll be fun. Thank you very much for stopping by the podcast today. We'll have all this in the show notes, how to get a hold of you on your LinkedIn, as well as get a hold of your group and everything else. Thank you for stopping by.
Yeah, thanks, Stu. Appreciate you having me.